This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're in the midst of the Olympics, a time to focus on world-class athletic competition. And, of course, where there's competition, there's cheating. Doping scandals are still with us, as they have been for decades. Our guest today helped to establish the first random out-of-competition drug testing program for track and field in the U.S. She also represented and prosecuted athletes in doping cases. Dorianne Lambalee Coleman is a law professor today, but she once was a world-class track star. Although when she started running track as a teenager, she didn't think really expect to rise to such heights. Dorianne moved around a lot as a kid, and track was mostly a way to make friends. But she earned a track scholarship to college and eventually landed a spot competing in her home country of Switzerland in the early 1980s. There, she became the Swiss national champion for the 800-meter race 2 years in a row. She also had success in this country as well. Dorianne now teaches law at Duke University and is on our program today. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank.
Let's talk about the Olympics first. I want to find out more how you came to be a track star and an expert in this field. But, you know, we're watching the Olympics. The doping stories are with us today. And you've seen track and field for decades now. So you know we shouldn't be surprised to see this, right? This is something that's been part of the industry for a while.
Absolutely. Doping has a long history, probably back to ancient Greece. But in the modern period, especially starting in the 1950s, the use of steroids proliferated. And it wasn't until really the late 80s that that the Olympic movement became serious about doping control. And so that period between the 1950s and the late 80s was rife with drugs. In the time since, of course, there have been real serious efforts at regulating the use of performance-enhancing substances. And the Olympic movement through the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has been more or less successful. In this period, this year in particular, it's managed to catch drug cheating again on a massive nationwide scale. Of course, the Russians are a lot of the Russian team is banned from the Olympics in Rio, but that's not new in our world.
Well, so you were part of the team that established the first random out of competition drug testing. I suppose we should maybe take us back to a time because we keep making this distinction out of competition drug testing. How did drug testing work before that?
So before the federation started out of competition drug testing, there was only in competition testing. And in the earlier periods, there was in competition testing only at the most elite competitions and only of the winners. Mm. So at the Olympics, it would be of the medalists, for example. At nationals, it would be of the winner or maybe whoever made a team if it was a team selection event. And so what that allows the athletes to do is essentially they know they will be tested on X day. If there's only in competition
right.
testing, and so they, you know, they can cycle off, they can take masking agents, and there are lots of things that you can do to skirt in competition tests, and that's why out of competition testing is viewed as sort of the gold standard of drug testing, because if it's done right, you can catch people who might not have cycled off or who might not realize you're coming that day or whatever.
Obviously, this had been known to track officials. Anybody in sports realizes what you just told us. So if they really wanted to clean it up, they should do out of competition. What was the resistance and what made it possible in the 80s for you and your team to actually establish this and get it, have it accepted?
So the resistance initially, and probably still is, that if you establish a drug testing program domestically or only in your sport, that and you're proactive about it and you're innovative about it the way we were trying to be with USA Track and Field in the late 80s, you essentially risk the sort of sullying your team, your sport, when no one else is going to be sullied, even though the same phenomena is going on everywhere. And so at USA Track and Field, for example, in the late 80s, after 1988 and the so-called Ben Johnson scandal, everyone was interested in sort of figuring out what to do. That was the obvious thing to do. But if only the United States did it, Then the U.S. athletes that were on drugs would test positive. The USA track and field would look dirty, and everyone else, at least we could maintain, they could maintain the fiction, and spectators could maintain the fiction that, oh, it was only the American athletes, and maybe the Canadians too, since Ben Johnson had been caught.
Meanwhile, they're getting away with it, so their athletes are winning more competitions because you're screening yours out.
Exactly.
Tell us about the Ben Johnson case and why that mattered to this whole question.
So Ben Johnson tested positive for stanozolol, which is an anabolic steroid, at the 1988 games in Seoul, and it was a watershed in the sense that up to that point, those kinds of performances, enhanced performances, had been relatively routine in several events, if not a lot of events. In track and field, but also in other sports, but the illusion had been maintained essentially that either sport was clean or there wasn't that much doping. I wasn't a spectator in that period; I was an athlete, and so from the inside, it was clearly an illusion that people might have had on the outside. We didn't have it, but the year before, well, actually in 1984, the USOC and several other international Olympic committees began doing more serious in competition testing, and so it was expected that people would have cycled off of their drugs in time for the Olympics. And so that he got caught and several other athletes also got caught that year was new. And what was also new was that it was published that he was caught, that the tests were revealed publicly. The results of the tests were revealed publicly. Before then, in the period 84 to 88, there were a lot of positives that just never surfaced. And so it was kind of an explosion onto the sort of international scene outside of sport, that there was this you couldn't hide it anymore, that there was this real problem with doping. And so it became kind of the watershed or the dividing line between, you know, this pre-testing era or the pre-serious testing era, and then the era where there became sort of demands for out-of-competition testing as a way to sort of try to deal with the problem.
So you talked about this concern among U.S. track officials that if you become the cleanest game in town, you're also going to look like the dirtiest.
Exactly. That was the irony, and it was a big risk. You know, the Athletes Advisory Committee, which was the committee that I was the counsel for, represents the athletes at USA Track and Field, and our view was that this was, you know, this was worth it. You know, we were going to have a hard time for a while, but that it was going to be worth it.
Well, tell us about that initially. What was the reaction and what was the effect on U.S. track? I mean, did it have that kind of blowback?
Yeah, no, I think it did. Yeah. I think it did. I mean, thankfully, the initial set of positives under our out-of-competition program were stimulants. And so sort of, you know, they aren't as bad, negative, in terms of the appearance. Mm-hmm. So people would test positive for just excessive amounts of cold medicine, for example, and that just has a different feel to it than steroids,
right.
And human growth hormone and things like that are much more sort of constructive of the body in a long term sense than cold medicine, which might give you a little bit of an edge for a couple of hours.
So give us a sense from the inside. I'm going to talk more about your athletic career as well in a few moments, but you were an athlete. You did compete on the international stage. Among athletes, what's the sense of in the psychology of using these drugs? I mean, do athletes generally feel like, I hate to use this stuff, but I can't possibly not? I have to be competitive, or what's the difference? Is there kind of indifference about it, and they wonder what all the hubbub is? What's the talk in the locker room?
I don't think it is neutral in the sense of your last point. I think that athletes believe that they need to do it to succeed. Either because they know their bodies and they know that sort of the natural hierarchy won't allow them, no matter how hard they work and how disciplined they are, won't allow them, for example, onto the podium at the Olympic Games or at a national championship or something that they really want, either just for personal, you know, sort of growth or money. I think it's more that they think they can't get there without it. And a lot of athletes convince themselves that in their event, for example, everyone is doing it. Or if they're not doing it, they're stupid because, you know, this is the way to get, you know, sort of means ends kind of thing.
How widespread is it, do you think? Should we be suspicious of every gold medal winner and every record breaker?
I hope not. I hope not. I mean, it definitely is. It's definitely a perception problem within and outside of sport. But you're asking me specifically about within sport among athletes. I think that particularly among clean athletes, it is reviled. There's a lot of resentment, both toward the athletes and the athletes who do it, the coaches who promote it, and the organizations that don't do a good job policing the sport. So, for example, you know, everyone is furious at WADA in this period for not having caught the Russian doping program earlier, especially because, you know, within the athlete community, rumors and or anecdotal knowledge is prevalent. And so I think that there's a lot of skepticism, but we also know a lot about how the substances function. And so we think we have a good sense of who is and who isn't doping. And so we may or may not be right, but based on trajectories and body type and things like that and changes, we have a pretty good sense of who is and who isn't. And that can allow us to really appreciate success when it's gained by individuals who we believe are expressing their natural talents and abilities, and also to be angry about those who we don't think are doing the same.
My guest is Dorianne Lambele-Coleman. She's a former international track star and lawyer who helped create anti-doping policies for track and field in the U.S. She teaches law at Duke right now, and our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest today, Dorianne Lambele-Coleman. She's a former international track star and a lawyer involved in creating anti-doping policies for track and field here in the U.S. back in the 80s. Today, she teaches law at Duke. So let's take you back to your earliest years. You were actually born in Switzerland.
Yes.
And your mother raised you as a single mom.
Yes.
And then you eventually moved to the United States, to New York.
Yes. We moved to the States when I was approximately 5 years old, between 5 and 6, to go to kindergarten. And so my mother could come and live in the States. She was excited about the idea of leaving Switzerland.
And living. So tell us about that, about growing up in New York and what life was like for you in those early years.
It was hard. I was born in Lausanne in Switzerland, which if you've been to Lausanne, you know it's a pretty idyllic place. It's everything that that the Lower East Side in Manhattan. We lived on First Street and First Avenue back in the period where it was. I grew up hearing that it was described as a Puerto Rican ghetto, and I think it looked that way in retrospect. So I left sort of the Swiss Riviera in all of the gorgeousness of Lausanne, the cleanliness, the lack of poverty, the absence of race differences, and was essentially plopped into the middle of sort of the most extreme version of all of that in the Lower East Side, which was at the time, again, pretty much a ghetto. It hadn't been gentrified yet. And so the combination of sort of leaving, you know, the transition in any event, but the particular transition, I think, was really hard. I also, my first French was my first language initially. And so in that period, I was also learning to speak English, and so started school as a native French speaker. Wow. in the public schools in the Lower East Side in Manhattan.
You were actually featured in a documentary by a French filmmaker at the time, and I looked at it and sort of did the best I could with my high school friends to try to understand it. But what was striking to me was this period in New York City history when Times Square was the porn capital of America, mm-hmm. where it was nothing like it is today or what it was decades earlier. And again, I think it demonstrated sort of the atmosphere that you grew up in. But tell us more about that, because it was also a political atmosphere for you, right?
Very much so. My mom had come to the States to essentially live in the United States in this period because it was just exciting for her as an idea. And her friends, the American friends that she had that she knew here that she came essentially to be around were very political, including the person who ended up being my stepdad for a few years. He and his family were I guess had always been a political family, African American political family, and they were quite involved in that period in the civil rights movement.
So you, the family eventually moved to San Francisco, right? And it was the Haight-Ashbury district.
Yeah, we actually lived at 653 Ashbury Street, which was
wow.
the corner of Haight-Ashbury
we
too. Yeah. Well, I was basically 10 to 12, I think, in that period. So I don't think I was there in the same way adults would be there, thankfully.
Give us an idea of the time. When was this?
So 1970 to 72. Yeah. I was in San Francisco.
And tell us about that period. Then you were now. This is you go from Luzon to New York City, and now you're in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury.
So we had moved to San Francisco along with my dad's sister and her husband and their family, in part because they thought that it was a better place to live at the end of the day than New York City, and also because my uncle, who was the only person in the family with a stable job, had gotten a position there. And so that's why we moved there. But again, I think the motivations for the adults were also political, and that was something, you know, there was stuff going on in San Francisco that they were interested in.
And you talked about it. I mean, you made reference to it, but your stepfather's family has a deep history in the civil rights movement going back a long way, right?
Yes. Again, everything is step for me, but my great-great-great-grandfather and grandmother were Ellen and William Craft, who were slaves on a Georgia plantation, and they escaped to slavery in part by disguising themselves as a slave owner and a slave. And the Crafts wrote a book called Running 1,000 Miles to Freedom in the late 1800s that documented their escape, and that's still widely taught in history departments around the country. The family also includes the Hemings family out of Monticello. It includes the Trotters, William Monroe Trotter, who's one of the first black newspaper owners and journalists out of Boston. And then later in the mid-50s, 60s, again, both my grandmother and her two children, my dad and his sister, were involved in Southern civil rights politics.
Because this is an important time, again, another important moment in a very, very long history of civil rights in America. What was that the topic of conversation around you? Were you embroiled in those conversations much?
I don't think I participated in them so much. I think because of my age and also the culture at the time, even in sort of more radical communities, was still that the children watched the adults and, wow. and didn't so much participate. I love this new vogue of having children as part of the discussion. It's part of what I love about my family. And we are very much embroiled in political discussions mm-hmm. in this period, including with my two sons. But I watched a lot, and it was the time of the Black Panther movement. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. Angela Davis was put in jail. I mean, all of that was part of the excitement for them of our lives.
Your stepfather passed away during this time. How did that affect you and your family?
It was hard. He committed suicide in 1972 and in San Francisco. And we left San Francisco, my mother, my brother, and sister and I, almost immediately afterwards, in part because my mother had always felt that moving out to the West Coast was sort of a little too far from Switzerland. She wasn't someone who ever expected to go back, and she didn't. But I think there's something primal about, you know, sort of where your people are. And when that happened, I think it was obviously shocking for everyone. And it made her feel more comfortable to be back on the East Coast. And so we moved back to New York, to Woodstock, New York. And so it's just more transitions, I think, right. In addition to just, you know, obviously the harm that comes from that kind of a personal event.
And you spent time going back and forth between the U.S. and Switzerland as a young girl, right?
I did. When we lived in New York City, I went back almost every summer and stayed with my grandmother, who had helped my mother raise me when we still lived in New York. And so I was lucky enough to be able to spend a lot of summers in Lausanne before we moved to San Francisco. And then when we moved back to Woodstock, or back to New York and moved to Woodstock, we We didn't go back to Switzerland for a bit, but we did go back for my ninth grade year, and the whole ninth grade year. And so I got to spend a year back there in the middle of my sort of secondary school.
So when did you become interested in track?
In late junior high school and early high school, I began, I sort of figured out from various gym class exercises and things that I could beat everybody, including the boys in that period. I think before puberty, really talented girls can still beat boys. After that, it becomes harder. And really, when I came back to the States after the year in Switzerland for ninth grade and 10th grade, I came back you know, with the expectation, and everyone in the high school I was going to had the expectation that I would be running. And from then on, it became quite a serious thing.
And you were watching on those trips back to Switzerland. You used to watch the Olympics with your grandmother, right?
I did. For whatever reason, it just worked out that when my mom could pay for me to go back, it happened to be Olympic year a lot. And so I sort of fell in love with the idea of the Olympics. I had rings up, you know, I had done posters with the Olympic rings that I had up on my wall in my bedroom, and aspired to be. Initially, I think it was a gymnast. I just wanted to be Nadia. That wasn't going to happen for various reasons. And then I thought I could be a skater. That also wasn't going to happen, pretty much for the same reasons. I just wasn't going to have the training opportunities. Running is really inexpensive.
Plus,
you can
plus
do
you
it
weren't
anywhere.
That good with a crowbar.
Yeah,
so.
No, I mean, I have no eye-hand coordination, so that's a problem. But running is really inexpensive in a lot of ways, and I just happen to be really good at it.
You're really good. In fact, you won a scholarship for track to Villanova, right?
I did. In fact, I was at a public high school in the middle of New York State, of course, around Woodstock, and I didn't have a lot of people around me who had gone to college, and so the guidance counselor at my high school told me that probably the only way I was going to get to go and pay for it was if I got a track scholarship, which turned out not to be right. Of course, there's financial aid, but we didn't know that. And so partly because I was really in love with running at that point and competing, and the idea of going to one of the top track schools in the country was really exciting and really affirming of all the work I'd been doing, but also because I thought we needed it. I went to Villanova, and Villanova at the time still is one of the top top women's programs, but at the time definitely one of the top programs in the country.
So what were you envisioning for yourself now? Did you see yourself becoming a world-class track star, or was this just a ticket to a career? How did you look at it?
No, I think in high school, I definitely thought of myself as eventually competing on the international stage. I think it's typical of really good high school athletes that they think they can have it all, and that's the aspiration. You want to be the best, and I didn't know that I could be the best, but I thought that if I worked hard, that I had the talent combined with the effort to make it internationally, and that's what my goal was.
Meanwhile, you were serious about academics, or at least it seems that way. You were a Soviet studies major, right?
I was, back in the day when there was still a Soviet Union.
That's right. Well, so why? What were you thinking? Diplomatic career, intelligence?
I don't think I was thinking that far forward. I think that we were encouraged early on to sort of, as kids are today, to think about what they might want to study. And for me, it was natural to think that that I would want to do something having to do with languages, because I spoke French and English fluently. I spoke Italian colloquially because we have family in the Italian part of Switzerland. I spent quite a lot of time there in the summers, and I had taken Spanish in high school, and so I knew I had a facility with languages, and so that seemed like an obvious kind of, you know, entree for me. But I wanted to do something harder, and in that period, the Soviet Union was like China is today. It was the other power. There were going to be a lot of opportunities, whether I got interested in politics or history or literature or business. I didn't know that I would be interested in any of those things in particular, but again, like China is today for a lot of young people, it's things having to do with China, things having to do with the Soviet Union kind of made sense for me, given my international background.
Yeah, you could have even been a campaign advisor to a Russian president,
and
then come here and you could have done the same thing.
Not a good idea.
Were you thinking all that at the time?
Not at all.
Who did? Tell us about competing with the Swiss national team. How did that happen?
So I was only a Swiss citizen. I only had Swiss nationality, Swiss citizenship until I was 21, I think. And so that was my choice. If I was going to compete internationally, I had to compete on the Swiss team. And so at some point in mid-college, they contacted me, or I contacted them. I'm not sure how that worked. And we started talking about my moving to Switzerland after college to compete.
What was that like? Because you were the Swiss national champion for the 800 meters in 82 and 83, right?
Correct. When I graduated from high school, I went directly to Switzerland and started competing that next week. It had all been set up that next week for the team. And so I competed internationally for them for those 2 years and won the national championship.
That's great. What was the culture like, and how did it compare to amateur athletics in the U.S. that you had already experienced?
It was wonderful in the sense that I finally had all of the support that athletes might imagine. Infrastructure, training, coaching. I didn't graduate from Villanova. I went to Cornell after my first year, and Cornell and Ivy League athletics have gotten quite competitive domestically, but at the time they were still Ivy League sports, and there were no scholarships. And it was in the beginning of the Title IX era, and so the men had a lot of opportunities the women didn't have. So I was finally, for the first time, in a place where, I had the highest level coaching, the highest level training infrastructure, traveling for training to altitude. All of those things all of a sudden become possible. And I had to work part-time, but I was otherwise well-supported. And so it was wonderful in those respects. On the other hand, the politics of selection is very different in small countries in Europe, and actually in most countries. It's more like Americans might be familiar with the gymnastics selections in the United States. It's kind of, how well they know you, how well they know sort of all these things that you do, but as well personality and things like that. And I really wasn't used to that, where in the States it's sort of like top three across the line, you make the team.
The numbers.
It's all metrics. Yeah.
Well, so your national champion, 82-83 Swiss national team, it would seem like the Olympics would be the next step for you, but it wasn't. Why not?
Correct. I in 83, I was approached by the folks at Nike, who had just launched Athletics West, which was for several years Nike's elite American track club. And it was based out of Eugene in that period. And they wanted all of the athletes that were on Athletics West, that were on Nike sponsorship, to move to Eugene and train with their coaches there, kind of like an American model of the East German training camps without the drugs, hopefully. And so I moved to Eugene, in part because I had spent 2 years in Switzerland and I think I wanted to come home, but also because I was a little frustrated with their selection mechanisms. And so I moved to Eugene to train that year before the 84 games. And that's also when I became a naturalized U.S. citizen, in order to do that. And I had an amazing year in Eugene. In retrospect, it was a really phenomenal experience, but it wasn't good for my training. It rains a lot. It's overcast a lot. And I think I was mentally a bit depressed by the weather, and also I didn't have the opportunity, because of the weather, to do all the speed training that I was accustomed to doing. And that was, I was a speed-based 800-meter runner, not a distance-based 800-meter runner, and they tried to change me into a distance-based 800-meter runner. I ran the fastest 10Ks of my life, but some really slow 800s at the end of the year, unfortunately.
Well, you also didn't compete in the World Championships, but you did come close in 83. There's one race in particular that I think we should hear the story.
It's the story of my life on the track. So in 1983, the World Championships were in Helsinki in the summer. I think they were in late July or in August. And a lot of the European runners who had almost qualified but needed one more race to sort of show their stuff went to a meet in Munich that was in the Munich Olympic Stadium. It was just, very big international competition with lots of fans and, lots of people in the stands. European track is phenomenal in that way. But it was basically set up, and several races were set up essentially to allow those of us who had not yet qualified for our national teams to, again, to show our stuff one last time. And I was in the 800. They had almost decided to put me on the team, but they still wanted to see one more race just to get some confidence in my abilities at that level. And we were, I remember we were warming up for the 800, and we were told that there would be a last minute entry. A woman who had been scheduled to run the 200 meters and who had felt a twinge in her calf muscle when she was warming up for the 200, and so was worried that she might hurt herself if she ran the 200, which is, you know,
a sprint,
obviously a sprint, a speed
sprint,
race,
right. Yeah.
Really high up on your toes, and so you're stressing your calf muscles a lot. But she had come to the competition to get a race in, and that's a psychological sort of training. There's a psychological training component to getting a race in, and so she wanted a racing experience, and so her coach asked if she could run the 800. It was Jarmila Kratochvílová. A Czech runner who at the time was the best 400-meter runner in the world, and her intent had been to run the 200 and the 400 at the World Championships. She was put in the 800. We had a rabbit who was scheduled, a pacemaker who was scheduled to put us on schedule, mm-hmm. For each 200 meters so that we could all make our national teams.
Yeah.
And she had never run an 800 before. And so she went out and she had been told there was a pacemaker and she'd been told not to stay behind the pacemaker so she wouldn't mess the race up for the rest of us. But she couldn't because she was too fast. she was too fast. Jarmila broke the world record in the 800 meters in that race. We went through the 400 in 55 seconds. We were supposed to go through in 58. And the rest was history for her and for us. For her, again, it was the world record, which still stands today. It's the most longstanding world record in all of women's track and field internationally. And none of us, I've spoken to a couple of the other women over the years, remember what we ran because all we remember is watching her way ahead of us and sort of being devastated by what was happening.
That was it. Not good enough to make the team.
Not at all, because we ran particularly slowly, I think, because we went out in 55.
Dorianne Lambele-Coleman is my guest, former international track star, now a lawyer who teaches at Duke, and we will continue our conversation on the state of things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Dorianne Lambele-Coleman, a former international track star and now a lawyer who helped create anti-doping policies for track and field in the U.S. She now teaches law at Duke. So you told the story about a Czech runner who is a late entry to your 800-meter race in 1983. She breaks the world record and your heart because you're not able to go on to the World Championships that year. But there's another story about this Czech runner, right? I mean, the fact is she wasn't just very fast running an 800-meter race at a 200-meter pace. There was also a fair amount of controversy around her status and how she got to be so good.
Yes. In that period, and again, this is the very middle of the 1980s, this is before real in-competition testing. There was some in-competition testing, but it wasn't rigorous and systematic, and it was certainly before out-of-competition testing. And the runners from the Eastern Bloc countries, and this was still, you know, pre-demise of the Soviet Union and the Soviet Bloc, were, you know, well known for their doping programs, their state-sponsored doping programs. And although most of the athletes in that period never tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs, the fact is that there wasn't testing for performance-enhancing drugs. And so all we can say for certainty for most of the athletes is that everyone had a lot of anecdotal knowledge and high levels of suspicion. Her world record is among the most controversial ever in that respect, and that's public knowledge. Even as I say that, it is the case that there is no public disclosure of any official positive sample out of that race or out of her subsequent victories at the World Championships in the 400 and 800. Mm-hmm. This was a couple of weeks later. She switched from the 200 to the 800 after she broke the world record for the World Championships and won both easily. No public positive tests.
But when it comes to the significance of these drugs, the impact and the damage that they can do, you told me something in the break that's fairly interesting. She now is the coach of the Czech national team, right?
Yes.
And is perhaps the only surviving member of that team?
not the only surviving member of that team, but a lot of the athletes who are part of the state sponsored, the female athletes especially, who are part of the state sponsored doping programs, suffered tremendously from medical problems, from health problems, and many of them are known to have died prematurely.
Well, you came back to the U.S. after that. You trained with the Athletics West program. We talked a little bit more about that. What did you do after that event?
So after after I competed for Athletics West, in that year in Eugene, I went to Los Angeles to compete. I'm looking for better weather and still really great coaching, which I did get from Joe Douglas, wonderful longtime coach of the Santa Monica Track Club. And I competed for the Santa Monica Track Club after I was done with my contract with Athletics West. And in that year, I also applied to law school. I was starting to become it was clear to me both that I think mostly because of the doping in my event in that period, it was clear to me that I was not going to progress farther than I had. And so sort of the dreams that you have growing up of making the Olympic team, of being on the podium, become clearly not realistic. And a lot of people stop because of that. A lot of people stick it out because they still want to see how fast they can go. And I did that for a couple of years. I mean, knowing, you know, after that 800 meter race in Munich, it became about how fast I could go, and I was still good enough to make teams, and so that was fun, and I got a lot of personal satisfaction out of it. But I wasn't chasing the same dream anymore, and so. Because I had had the experience, the great academic experience I had had, moving from Villanova to Cornell and getting to develop myself as a student and future professional, I always had in my mind that when I got really frustrated with the sport, I would do something. Initially, the idea was I was going to become a Sovietologist. In that period, the Soviet Union started to disintegrate, and of course, Sovietologists became Kremlinologists. But that seemed not to be what I was bound to do. And so, I applied to law school. Like a lot of people apply to law school who don't know anything about it, because it's the thing that humanities folks do when they want a regular, you know, sort of profession that's gonna be stable and do well. And I love to read and write. I still love to read and write. And so I thought that being a student and being challenged in those respects was going to be great.
You went out of law school, became a lawyer. And interestingly enough, you went on to prosecute and defend athletes in doping cases. Was that something deliberate on your part? Did you sort of seek those cases out?
No, it was an offshoot of our development of the random out of competition drug testing program with USA Track and Field. So so when that program was developed, we also developed, and by we I mean my husband Jim Coleman, who's also on the faculty at Duke with me. He was also at Wilmer Cutler, which is the firm I was at in D.C. after law school, and we took on the development of the drug testing programs as part of our pro bono work for the firm. And then also Edwin Moses and Harvey Glantz were instrumental at the athletics, the Athletes Advisory Council. And so together, sort of as a team, we developed these protocols for out of competition testing. But of course, we also had to have procedures to try the cases that arose out of the program, because there was nothing.
Right.
There was no infrastructure for drug testing. So there was no infrastructure for dealing with cases that arose out of drug testing. And so we developed those procedures. And to get the program going, Jim and I prosecuted the initial set of cases that arose out of the program. And we stopped doing that after a couple of years. It got turned over to a law firm that did it sort of as a routine matter. We only represented one athlete who was charged with doping, and that was Mary Decker Slaney. We didn't take on defense of doping violations at all otherwise. And the reason we took Mary's case is because Mary's a friend of mine. I had trained with her. I had raced with her. I had been in drug testing with her in Europe when nobody else was getting drug tested. When they were starting to do drug testing, they would pick those of us who they thought were probably clean and put us through the testing, because that would
yield no more positives.
The sport would remain clean. There would be no positive tests. And so I just believed in her. I still believe in her. And so we took it on for that reason.
It's interesting. I mean, you go back over that because, again, that gets to the sort of the kind of testing that you talked about. The fact is, if we're only going to do testing at the event, we can actually select individuals who we know are clean. I mean, this is another aspect of, you know, sort of the weakness of that kind of testing. And you say Mary Decker at the time was one of those athletes they always chose.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they knew she was clean.
Absolutely. I mean, that doesn't work. It doesn't work that way anymore. Now top three get tested.
Right.
Or top three plus one random person in the race.
Right.
You know, they're much more systematic about it. But at the time, in these early stages, when it was just dipping, you know, it's starting to become popular to think about drug testing. For a long time, nobody thought about it.
Right.
But when it became popular, they're sort of dipping their toes in the water. They're going to say they do it, but they don't want any trouble.
Yeah. Tell us about her case, because it is a fascinating case.
So Mary had an elevated TE ratio at the Olympic trials for the Atlanta Games.
Is testosterone?
No, it's not testosterone. TE is testosterone to epitestosterone. It's a ratio of testosterone to its metabolite.
Okay.
One of the things that is notable about her case is that her testosterone levels were always normal. There was nothing ever in her samples that revealed either an elevated testosterone level for women in the women's range of testosterone levels, but also never elevated compared to her own T levels in earlier and subsequent tests. So her T levels were normal. It was her epi level, her epitestosterone level, that somehow got skewed. And that was not in that period. The TE ratio test was the only test the Olympic movement had, that anyone had, for testosterone in that period. And it was thought that it was likely that testosterone would appear in a ratio to its byproduct, to its metabolite. And so they picked this ratio above which, you know, they would start to do further analysis of your T levels to see if that was a doping. So her ratio was not actually itself a doping positive, but it was suspicion of dope. It was classified as suspicion of doping. And so then there's the subsequent investigation of your endocrine levels and all of that to determine whether it is likely to be exogenous use of testosterone as opposed to natural endogenous processes.
So and I think the centerpiece of your defense was that this test was not a very good test.
No, it wasn't a very good test. It was bad science. But the Olympic movement and other sports governing bodies, anti-doping regulatory agencies, stopped using it very shortly afterwards. And so we were one of several athletes and their counsels who challenged the scientific validity of the test. It was acknowledged that in many respects it wasn't a good test. But again, because it was the only one, to drop it because of its scientific flaws would have been essentially to admit defeat in a period where athletes were moving away from synthetic anabolics to back to endogenous anabolics, and in particular testosterone, because it was believed that, well, the technology for testing for steroids clearly shows synthetics. The graphs reveal synthetics very, very easily.
Right.
And so athletes were starting to go back to exogenous use of testosterone.
So that's interesting, because basically you get the world governing bodies to agree with you. Yeah, this is probably not a very good test. And in fact, some governing bodies begin to stop using it because it's so bad. But this doesn't clear Mary Decker.
No, I mean, this was the transition period, right?
Yeah.
And again, because the IAAF, which is the International Federation for Athletics for Track and Field, knew that athletes were moving to the exogenous use of a natural substance, testosterone, they felt like they needed to stick by the test until there was a better one. And better meant both scientifically more valid, but also cost effective for them, because they had, you know, at this point there was wide scale doping control, and so it's an expensive program, and so they didn't feel like they could relinquish use of the test, and so they just stuck to their guns whenever anybody had an elevated TE ratio.
And in her case, they essentially said, if you can prove to us you didn't use it, then okay.
Right.
Which is
so we won her case in the United States at the domestic level. The hearing process for doping cases is basically initially at the domestic level, but then it can be challenged internationally. And they could have accepted the decision of the American hearing panel, but they didn't. They challenged it. But when they challenged it, they said, they basically flipped the burden of proof They basically flipped the burden of proof and said, you have to prove to us that your elevated TE ratio was not caused by exogenous use. In other words, that you did not take exogenous testosterone. And there's literally no way to prove that negative. We could prove that it was highly unlikely that it was not. But the fact that they had challenged the result at USA Track and Field, where we had established that it was highly likely not, made it clear that we were not going to be able to. And they imposed a burden of clear and convincing evidence on us in addition.
I ask you to take a step back at this point and take a look at the international competition, the Olympics. We hear a lot about, well, this is a way to bring people together. The whole world is focused on this thing. I don't know. What do you make of it? I mean, it seems to me the critique is, no, it's nationalism writ large. It's nothing about bringing us together. It's about our differences. And then, obviously, the stakes are so high. The competition at this level is so high. Cheating is inevitable. What this does to human bodies, what it tells children about who they are and how they could be. Well, what's your sense of whether or not we should be paying attention to the Olympics at all? Are we engaged in a giant game of cops and robbers here that will never end, or is there something virtuous about this kind of competition?
So a practicing lawyer would say that's a compound question.
It is.
Right?
It is.
Sort it out. So I actually believe that the Olympic movement and the Olympic Games are a place for coming together. They are absolutely about highlighting national achievements. And so everywhere you go, if you turn on the coverage in the United States, if you turn on the coverage in England, it's going to be sort of nationally oriented. There's no question that it's a showcase for that. But there's also no question that at the Olympic Games, in the Athletes' Village, there is a lot of community building that's going on. There are great images that become iconic images of a South Korean and a North Korean embracing at a tournament. You know, things like that that are symbolic, that are signaling of greater possibilities. I think that's the optimistic take, right? In terms of body image, I think that that's inherent in elite sport.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's going to be impossible to continue to cultivate elite sport without cultivating elite athletes who then look like elite athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And if the messaging is you're not a good person or you're not worthy if you don't look like this, that's a problem. But if it's still it remains what it was always intended to be, which is showcasing natural talents and abilities, the best that you can be as a human being.
Doesn't this have a worse effect on women? It seems to me if you're a shot putter or some sort of very large athlete and you're a male, that's fine. You know, it's a big guy, and nobody's going to talk about your hairy legs or your waistline. For women, it does seem to be a different standard and judged on a different scale.
Michelle Carter is beautiful. Michelle Carter is an American shot putter who won the first gold medal ever, I think, for the United States in the shot put, and she's just beautiful. She's a beautiful woman. She's also a fantastic person. I do think that that in our culture in the United States, there are women have body image issues, and there are ways in which the way Olympic athletes are showcased for commercial purposes by, for example, NBC and the Olympic Committee may contribute to that. On the other hand, having been an elite athlete and recognizing sort of again the beauty in the cultivation of our bodies to those ends, to those instrumental ends, which are you know, higher, faster, stronger in the particular ways that the event guides you is just a phenomenal thing.
Dorianne Lombele-Coleman is a former international track star and a lawyer, now teaches law at Duke. Thank you so much for being
here. You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, Ormond, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brett Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.